This is Ash and Di Morton, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 5th of August 2011. Ash and Di Morton, Part 3.
Where were you, Ash, when the three men went missing from Faraday? And what year was that?
That was the 82 winter. at the time, we were actually out on the sea ice with the dogs travelling through the fjords. So it was just because we were hearing things over the radio. Because, you know, in those days, all the bases were talking to each other on the radio all the time, really. And when you're in the field, you're listening to the radio. Yeah.
Remind me of the incident.
Well, it was... There were three guys at Faraday who had gone across to Petermann Island on the sea ice, and it's not very far. I can't remember if it's 8 or 12 miles, something like that, or might even be less. They'd travelled across there, and there was a hut there, and they were living in the hut there, just a recreation trip from base, and they had some bad weather and the sea ice had blown out. And then it had reformed, but it wasn't very thick. So it wasn't very strong, really. And I think they'd been advised to stay there until it got thicker. But they decided to go back to Faraday. And somewhere, well, between the time they left Petermann Island and before they got to Faraday, the wind blew up and the ice just broke up, and they would have gone with it. When the sea ice is quite fresh, it's fairly flexible, but it has got no strength in it. So you could probably ski across it on skis and you wouldn't go through, but if you've got a wind up that, especially if strong wind up that with open sea to the west of there, then it would have just broken up the ice.
So what was it like listening to that unfolding on the radio?
Well, mostly you thought they were being, it was just a silly thing to do. There've been a few sort of accidents or whatever you like to call them that have happened, and often it's been people not being sensible, really. People, or just a whole series of little things that just add up and just keep increasing, and then it happens. It's a bit like the Shambles accident. That was just a series of events that then led up to people being killed, really.
Remind me of that one, if you're...
All right. That was the year before I was at Rothera, the 81 winter. Four people were out on the Adelaide Island. There were two parties of two people. There was a GA and one of the base guys down at the southern end of the island, and a GA and one of the other guys. One of them was a mechanic and one was a cook, out with two GAs, and one of them was at the north end of the island, and it's just a whole series of events that just got worse and worse. There were up in an area with deep, soft snow that people wouldn't normally go in the winter, and they broke a track on their skidoo. They only had one skidoo and two sledges, and then they were travelling back south, back towards base. The guy that was not the GA was travelling on the sledge, but he was getting frostbite on his face because he was just out in the elements, really, on the sledge. And then they had problems with soft snow, and it was taking them quite a long time to get back to base. So they joined up with the party that were coming, the other party that came up from the south end of the island, to go through the Shambles Glacier up McCullum Pass and back to Rothera. So they joined up, and they had three skidoos and all the sledges and stuff, but because they didn't have enough skidoos for everybody, they decided that one of the guys would just travel on the back of the skidoo. And then it was, they weren't travelling linked together either. And then it was not very good weather, and I'd been waiting there for quite a while because of bad weather. So they'd been out for a long time. They wanted to get back to base, and it was a Saturday night, and people like to get back to Saturday night because it's a better meal on a Saturday night. And they're travelling in bad weather down, and they're off route, and the first skidoo and sledge went across no problem, but because of the weight on the second skidoo, it broke through a crevasse and went in. And ultimately, both the guys on that skidoo were killed.
When you hear about these accidents whilst you're in the Antarctic, does it change the way you go about what you do?
Well, I suppose you got to, you learn from these things, I think, yeah. Because, when I've been doing field work since then, you try to eliminate all these little things that add up to that out of the equation. So you don't travel when you can't see, what the snow conditions are like, and you just try to eliminate all the errors out and all the, just to reduce any errors that you can.
You strike me as being a cautious man anyway.
Yeah.
So does it make you even more cautious?
No, I don't think so, no.
No.
You just got to think about all these individual little things that are there, and just, often sometimes, like when we're on the Ronnie, we'd pack up the gear in the morning to travel to a next site, and if by the time you've got all the gear packed up, the weather's manked in, you would stop, you'd put the tent up again, you'd put the gear back out, but then, 2 hours later it may clear, so then you have to go through the procedure again, you've got to pack up and go and travel. You've just got to accept that that's the safe way to do it, even if you've got to unpack and pack and unpack and pack it, which can take an hour or more at a time. Even if you do that three times a day or something, you, rather than just going on blindly hoping that it's going to be all right, you just got to do it the safe way, really. Yeah.
One of the truisms about accidents is that they usually are a result of a series of small incidents that build up.
Yeah.
One after the other. So does a good GA spot that pattern beginning to happen? In other words, if it's four incidents for an accident, you begin to realise after two or three incidents that there's an accident.
No, I think you try to stop it before the one or the two, really. Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you feel when you hear about that? Are you sad for the people involved, or do you get slightly angry?
Because a few years after the, a couple of years after the Faraday guys went missing, we were talking to people that had been at Faraday, and some of the things they were doing there then, we wouldn't have done, wouldn't have even considered at Rothera. And they were, because the accident happened, they introduced regulations and things. The ice had to be a certain thickness before you could go on it, and you had to go on skis and then all the rest of it. But then, you know, a couple of years later, with people, because there were regulations, people weren't signing out and were going out around the island on skis and falling through the ice and things like that, which, so, you know, for some people, it hadn't been a learning experience at all. And that was quite scary in some ways. Mm. And, you know, in the first years were at Rotherhithe, we developed a system of, we actually put skidoos over cliffs linked up to show that you could actually stop it, you know, you could make it safe. And then you hear about people at other bases that would implement half of the system but not the other half. So they actually made the whole thing worse by not doing the whole thing. And, you know, and this is years after you've got the, you know, the system working well. Yeah. So in that way, it's just, it is a bit frustrating that people are not...
Well, Bass wasn't in enforcing them.
Well, it's...
Wasn't enforcing the...
Well, yeah, I think... Them. Yeah. But I think it's the way... Sometimes it's the way people interpret it. I mean, also, like, for quite a long time, at a place like Halley, they didn't actually... You know, they had GAs there sometimes, but a lot of the time in the winter they didn't have a GA. So people would get this information, but it was how they interpreted it and how they, you know, and how they passed on information year to year as well, I think, yeah.
Looking back, are you surprised that Bass's safety... procedures weren't more watertight?
I don't know. Well, the thing is that I probably now they got lots of procedures, but it depends on somebody being sensible and implementing them. And really, because I think you can have any number of regulations, but if somebody's sensible there without any regulations, they can do it, you know, safely.
What were the Americans like on the sensible front?
Oh, generally, they're all right. They had two seasons out of McMurdo. We went across to in through New Zealand to McMurdo, and then we were out at a camp on Ice Stream D. There was three big ice streams which come down off the plateau into the Ross Ice Shelf, and they're like immense glaciers, really. They're like 20 miles across, kind of thing. And they had a camp there, which was quite a big camp. So the Americans got a totally different way of doing things. Everything's, well, sort of bigger, really. So because we're going in there, they had to put a camp in. So therefore they need a camp manager, they need to put people to put the camp in, they need a radio operator, they need a cook, they need a mechanic to groom the runway, because they, you know, once it gets above a certain size, they have to fly a Herc in to take all the gear in. So therefore they need a vehicle to groom the runway so that the Herc can land. And you've got to, you know, do that fairly continuously. And then you've got to fly fuel in for the vehicle that grooms the runway. So it ended up being quite a big operation, really. But the first year was, it was all right, actually, because most of it, there was a joint Bass American, but it was sort of separate. And I was working with Ed King from Bass. So a lot of the time we were just travelling around doing our own work, separate from the Americans, really. And so we actually went out to some sort of remote sites from the main camp and worked and then travelled back. The second season, it was a big travelling seismic project, and there were... Eight, ten. It was eight or ten people. So there was eight or ten skidoos, probably 15 sledges, and some of them were double sledges with a little hat on them for all the recording equipment. And the, can't remember how long the seismic array was, something like 5 or 10 kilometres long. It must have been 10 kilometres, yeah. So once we started, the seismic array was in, must have been 500 metres, 500 metre length or something. No, 100 metre length. So the whole array was laid out, and then we'd pick up the back 100 metres, it would go forward to the front, and then the drilling team, which were drilling the hole for the seismics, for the explosives, would then travel forward another 100 metres. You'd shoot it off, and then you'd just do the same thing again. So it was very big and very slow. And
Were the Americans efficient in the way they conduct themselves?
Well, that's stuff in the field was fairly efficient. Yeah, the information they were getting back was very, a lot of data back from it. But then we'd do lines in certain places and then move. But a lot of the guys that were there were students from the universities. Some of them had never been to the Antarctic before. Some of them were from Texas or Mississippi or something, and they'd never seen snow before. And they didn't have any practical... They went through the snow school at McMurdo, but they didn't have any real practical experience using skidoos and stuff. So, they'd stop a skidoo and expect the sledge, they'd put the brakes on the skidoo and stop, and the sledge would be coming up at the same speed as they were travelling up from behind, and they'd be surprised that it crashed into them or almost knocked them over.
Didn't they lose a lot of stuff?
Yeah, and for me it was quite frustrating because I ended up, there was only two GAs on the project, and I ended up being the one following behind all the time, picking up things that people had dropped. And it's amazing that people could drop a sledge and not notice. And so sometimes when they stop for to have a drink out of the thermos, I'd come in from behind and I'd be pulling two extra sledges or a drum of fuel or something like that that people had lost off their sledges. It was just amazing, really.
There's this perception, isn't there, that the British produce more science with fewer resources than the Americans.
Yeah.
Even though we've got fewer resources, we do more science.
Yeah.
And they've got more planes, more machines, more personnel. Is that your view as well?
Yeah, just that they... out in the field camps and that, there's just a big base of support people a greater number of support people than... the number of scientists, really, yeah.
Mm.
But also it's just that, getting out of McMurdo, it's just Hercules flights to get anywhere, apart unless it's really close, and then they use a twin otter.
Did you spot any cultural variations at McMurdo compared to British camps?
Oh, it's just the size of it, really, and there were three bars there. It's just a little town. It's just a totally different thing. And people, I guess in some ways, some of the best bases have gone a little bit that way as well, with, having people doing the domestic stuff as well. Mm. Certainly at McMurdo, there's a whole crew that just go around cleaning up and, doing waste, and there's somebody for every job at McMurdo. There's a postman and there's a somebody for everything. And it is very much a 9-to-5 job. But then I think Bess has got quite like that as well on the bases. Well,
my next question is, over the 20-odd years, nearly 30 years that you've been going south, how have attitudes towards being south and working south changed?
They've changed a lot, I think.
In what way?
Well, when I first went down, you know, we were going to the Antarctic and it was, we didn't expect it to be luxurious or anything. You know, when we were first at Rothera, it was quite a small building. The toilets were Elsan buckets, you know, you had to empty them every day, and the person on Gash had to go around and collect all the ship buckets, take them on a sledge and down to the bay and chuck them away. And you had to do everything like that. If you wanted water, you dug snow, melted it, and you had water. So you really only had a shower on a Saturday night.
So has the nature of the FID changed?
Oh, yeah.
In what way?
Well, it was certainly like on the base there that when I was first down, everybody did everything. You know, there wasn't, you know, there's some things that were technical that not everybody did, but generally everybody took part in every job. And, you know, on Sunday the cook had a day off and everybody cooked. And but then the first time I really noticed it was in, must have been 18, when I was back in 88, they'd put in a pipeline for water, salt water up to the base. Well, there was always a pipeline for salt water for the RRO, but it never really worked very well. But by then they had a reverse osmosis for getting water. So then they had a plumber for doing that. So then immediately nobody else wants to have anything to do with anything plumbing. And it just got more and more like that, that everybody's job became more insular and isolated from everybody else, and everybody just did their own job and their own specific thing, and it became more 9 to 5 and also like more 6 days a week kind of thing as well. When I was first down there in the winters, that if it was a good day on Monday, you might go out with the dogs, but if it was a bad day on Sunday, you'd work. You didn't have a fixed routine of like a 5 or 6 day week or anything. You just worked the work that needed to be done, even though you'd be working at night time. Because one winter we were short on GAs in the winter, so we're having to do the work of more people with less people kind of thing. So you're working long hours in the nights, but the job needed doing and you just did it.
Has that that's evaporated, has it?
It's more like
a job.
It's more like a 9 to 5 job to do your specific job, you know, and as soon as Friday night comes or 5 o'clock comes, that's it.
Final question, so final answer. In 1993, when you received the Polar Medal, what did the Queen say to you?
she, I don't know what she said, really.
Do you know what you told me?
He
signed the Official Secrets Act, so he can't divulge the information. Liar.
For the record,
I can't remember much. It wasn't much, really. I don't know. There was something about going, you've been down there a few times, or you like going down there or something like that. But it's just that other people keep asking me about it, so I just say, I can't really say, you know. It wasn't anything particular.
The usual question is, have you come far? Which in your case, the answer is yes.
Yes.
But how's he changed? How's the Antarctic changed, Ash? Over the years you've known him?
I've got slower.
Yeah, no, I think he misses the old camaraderie of the bases. You know, when, like he was saying, how it's changed so much. I think he you know, because everybody did everything and now it's all bits of this, but, you know, you've got your own specific job. I think he seems to miss that a bit.
Yeah, I guess that's probably why I enjoyed going back to Husvik, because it was, you know, it's comfortable, but it's very basic. And then also the other seasons on South George were in the field. But yeah, I wouldn't particularly like to work on out of Rotherhaw or anything. It's just big and personal and, yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
You've been working on Halley for the last 3 years. Are you planning to go again?
Yeah, yeah. But that's different. That's just for the money.
No, we'll leave it. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Di.
No problem.